in this land forever. I offer you the floor. We have time for two questions, please.
Tiempo para dos preguntas, por favor.
Un saludo. Mi nombre es Jorge Avedrapo, profesor.
Greetings. My name is Jorge Avedrapo. Here is my question. It is true that the Zionists considered several options, territorial options, to carry out their projects among some Latin American countries. I mean, finally, what could happen in the future at a global level if the advance of Israel's colonial project is not stopped?
El avance del proyecto colonial de Israel.
Efectivamente, Jorge, entre el primero y el cuarto Congreso sionista.
Indeed, Jorge, between the first and the fourth Zionist congresses, most of them held in Basel, Switzerland, several alternatives were put into discussion, including Uganda and Chilean-Argentine Patagonia. The underlying theme was that there was no excuse that could be used to expel the inhabitants of these territories, and therefore they resorted to the myths of the biblical promise and the chosen people to sustain a colonial project like Zionism. And that is why Palestine ended up being chosen. Furthermore, if one looks at this as a projection not only of a Palestinian issue, because the problem is not only here. This is a problem of the global North-South confrontation, and therefore what happens in Palestine will have an intimate relationship with what happens in the Western Sahara, with what happens in other parts of the world, in Gualmapo, in our country, where the hegemonic classes, world imperialism, and transnational imperialism must do everything possible to protect the interests they harvest through occupying every inch of this territory and controlling every inch of the market and effectively appropriating any common property or natural resources. This strategy exists in the world. Therefore, from my humble perspective, the only possibility of reaching a just solution in Palestine is the overcoming of capitalism on a global scale.
Es la superación del capitalismo a escala global.
Hola, mi nombre es Carlota.
I am Carolina Espina. I am president of the Luis Emilio Recovera Collection and Research Center in Zeiler. My question is, why is the word apartheid used to refer to the Israeli policy against Palestine?
El apartheid es un concepto que se utiliza.
Apartheid is a concept that is used to refer to states or societies where there are two different systems inside them. For example, in South African apartheid, where within the same country, South Africa, there was a system for whites and a system for people of African descent. This system is seen today in Palestine and also in Israel, because not only within Israel there are first and second category citizens and different systems for those who are historically Palestinian and for Israelis citizens, but things are also tough for those who have recently arrived there and have just adopted Israeli citizenship. That's because they are Zionists and have many more rights than the Palestinians who have lived in Israel since before their birth. In addition, what we are seeing today in Gaza and the West Bank is a situation where the Israelis and the occupation, the illegal occupying power, the illegal Israeli settlers have all the rights, but the Palestinians have none. That is why the word apartheid was coined, and that is why it has been expanding the possibility of everyone recognizing the Israeli occupation as an apartheid system. We must never forget that in 1974, the United Nations General Assembly decreed that Zionism was a form of racism, homologously comparable to South African apartheid. This is while, due to the changes in the correlation of forces and North American and European pressure, this resolution was annulled several decades later. But this has not annulled the spirit and essence of Zionism, that in all these years, nothing has changed.
We'll be right back.
Lo he mencionado en otros programas.
I have mentioned it in other programs, and I reiterate it today with more force than ever. Palestine, in its 5,000 years of history, has lived only 120 years of peace. The Palestinian people consisted of an ethnic strain absolutely intercultural, composed of Jews, Christians, Muslims, atheists, belonging to diverse peoples who have settled in Palestine at some point in history. They have been there since before the first invaders arrived, and they will surely be there after the last ones leave. Today, thousands of supposed Israeli citizens have abandoned Israel because they no longer feel safe among the Palestinians. The Palestinian nation sink their legs and roots into the ground of their homeland, where they are born, grow, and die. That's because Palestine is their land. I invite you to watch this program next week to learn more about the concept of genocide in Gaza. Don't miss the next episode of A Window to Palestine.
En el próximo capítulo de Ventana a Palestina.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
As the Zionist regime's invasion of Gaza enters its 6th month, the impact on Palestinian children has been devastating. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, UN agencies report that, following the Zionist regime's invasion of Gaza, at least 17,000 Palestinian children have been orphaned or separated from relatives, and 1 in 6 children under the age of 2 are acutely malnourished. The Health Ministry in Gaza reported that 23 children died from malnutrition and dehydration in recent weeks. At least 32,000 people killed in Gaza, over 13,000 are children. The UN has warned that nearly 580,000 Palestinians, a quarter of Gaza's population, are one step away from famine. There are many such horrible recollections. The psychological trauma rooted in the ravages of war are scars that last a lifetime for children. The Zionist regime continues to block humanitarian aid from reaching Palestinians in Gaza and has attacked Palestinians attempting to receive aid. The last day of February witnessed Israeli regime forces massacring over 100 unarmed Palestinians, queuing for flour and humanitarian assistance. 3 days later, the Zionist regime killed 9 Palestinian civilians in line for flour in 2 separate attacks. Having already vetoed 3 UN Security Council resolutions for a ceasefire, the Biden administration also blocked a statement that condemned the flour bag massacre, as it did not have all the facts yet on the ground. Even though Washington has supplied the Zionist regime military with massive quantities of munitions and political cover, it has consistently claimed that it is unable to influence Israeli regime policy. Instead, the Biden administration initiated airdrops of ready meals into Rafah. The airdrops are not even close to sufficient considering the dire needs of the population. And on March 8, the falling crates killed five people, including two children, when a parachute or parachutes failed to open. Biden's proposed temporary port will take weeks to complete as disease and malnourishment grow. Meanwhile, the child killer regime of Israel has continued its campaign and is employing American weapons. As the first aid drops were delivered, an Israeli drone strike targeted Palestinians huddling in tents outside Rafah's Emirati hospital. At least 11 civilians, including children and two health workers, were killed, and at least 50 people were injured. For 5 months, the Biden administration has defended Israel's actions and offered only muted criticism. Washington has remained steadfast in its support, despite the overwhelming evidence of war crimes, including the determination by the International Court of Justice of a genocide. Spokespersons for the White House, State Department, and National Security Council, as well as President Biden and Secretary of State Antony Blinken, have repeatedly dismissed or diminished reports by the United Nations, journalists, and humanitarian organizations of the humanitarian catastrophe that has been live-streamed to a horrified global audience. Even after the flour bag massacre, NSC spokesman John Kirby insisted that Israel has tried to help with the delivery of humanitarian assistance, yet a handful of Israeli protesters have been successful in blocking aid trucks from entering Gaza. The carnival-like atmosphere of these Israeli protesters at the border crossing has occurred in full view of international media as well as the Zionist regime's military. The child killer regime of Israel has also prevented basic necessities from entering Gaza and contributed to the pain and suffering of Palestinian children. CNN has reported that maternity kits, sleeping bags, and equipments have been barred from entering Gaza. Anesthetics, oxygen cylinders, and crutches are also on the list of rejected items. The shocking scenes of children undergoing surgical procedures and amputations without anesthesia have now become routine, as has the acronym WCNSF for Wounded Child with No Surviving Family. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, 6 November, warning that Gaza was becoming a graveyard for children, has been realized. Hend Rajab, a 6-year-old girl, who called begging for help after the Zionist regime troops targeted the car in which she and her family were traveling, was killed after a long wait along with the paramedics who went to save her. Infants like 45-day-old Mahmoud Fatou, who died due to severe dehydration and malnutrition, or Ahmad, a child who was rescued after 9 days under the rubble, a skeleton, or Talin, 10, who recognized her mother's body by the hair. And there are countless stories of mothers who held their children in arms when they took their last breath. And this is only a partial telling. There are thousands of others whose stories we don't know. With thousands still buried under the rubble, the stories of many of the dead children may never be told. Yet the Biden administration repeatedly insists it needs more evidence before it can condemn or criticize the Zionist regime's actions, standards it has not applied to Palestinians or UN agencies or the ICJ. Children in Gaza have suffered the loss of their closest family members, in many cases their parents, siblings, grandparents, and other relatives. Their homes and schools have been destroyed, their neighbors killed or displaced. Their books and toys have been lost, their pets have been killed, their favorite park has been razed. Under constant bombardment, the Palestinian children are still grappling with the greatest challenges of siege, destruction, displacement, and starvation. These challenges will only increase in the weeks and months after the fighting ends. And the children will never forgive the silence and complicity of Western regimes who supported the Zionist regime's actions. Economic divide.
There is no doubt that the Israeli economy is taking a beating due to the genocidal war that is waging against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Another hit that the economy is taking is on the boycott front. But how much of a hit? Is it enough to make a difference? And how about on other fronts like education boycott or cultural boycott and on diplomatic fronts? Those are some of the issues we'll be covering in this edition of Economic Divide. Some of the headlines coming up, the call for a boycott, it has had an effect on major brands. Southeast Asia in particular, and Muslim countries. We will be taking a look at that. And also, obviously, companies that are profiting from the genocide that's taking place in the Gaza Strip. Another one of our highlights is going to be on U.S. Companies' Israeli investments, in particular, Intel. It goes by INTC, the chip-making giant. A $25 billion investment on occupied land, but freezing U.S. expansion. That means that it's investing in the genocide that's taking place. And then finally, we're going to take a look at the boycott success rate. Two organizations stand out in particular, Starbucks and McDonald's, on how it has been impacted. Also, grassroots organic boycott is another area we're going to be taking a look at, along with diplomatic educational boycott.
Calls for boycotting products perceived to have links to Israel are gaining momentum across Southeast Asia, and their impact on major brands' bottom lines is becoming increasingly noticeable, like on Puma, Chevron, HP, Volvo, and Siemens. In the case of McDonald's, the company said in February that the aggression was part of the reason international sales rose by just 0.7% during the fourth quarter of 2023. Down sharply from a 16.5% expansion during the same period the previous year. In an earnings call, McDonald's CEO Chris Kempczinski said, "The most pronounced impact that we're seeing is in the Middle East and in Muslim countries, like Indonesia and Malaysia." Other brands that have been affected by boycotts include Unilever and coffee chain Starbucks. Unilever, which produces Dove soap, Ben & Jerry's ice cream, and Knorr stock cubes, said in February that sales in Indonesia had experienced a double-digit decline during the fourth quarter last year as a result of geopolitically focused consumer-facing campaigns. In the case of Starbucks, the company's franchisee in Malaysia, Berjaya Food, reported a 38.2% drop in revenue in the fourth quarter of last year, which it attributed to an ongoing boycott. Time now to take a look at some social media posts. And believe me, on this topic, there were so many that we looked at. So here goes with the ones that we picked. Google reinstating No Thanks app for identifying boycotting Israeli-linked companies. That's pretty interesting. Let's find out how this works, actually. Here's an explanation of that, showing how widespread this type of software is used.
Starting today, the boycott against Israel is changed forever. There's a new app called No Thanks. It's on iOS and Android, and it lets anybody, anywhere, scan the barcode of any product to see whether or not that product is on the boycott for Israel list. For example, it'll tell you whether or not that fruit you're trying to buy was grown in a legal settlement, or if the company that made the product you're buying is profiting off of the oppression of the Palestinians.
Okay, now, Movement Win, 100-plus cultural organizations have endorsed the 2004 call of the Palestinian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel, PACBI, over the past 6 months. It said, join us. Next, Israel wants no witnesses. Are we going to let them? Never. We will continue to share, march, and boycott like we have never before. I am boycotting like my life depends on it. And we are millions doing it. We will starve them economically. Sanction Israel now. And then the UN Special Rapporteur, Francesca Albanese, beacon of truth. She speaks here of the genocide under the scars of Palestinian children, who will suffer for generations to come. She calls for arms embargo, boycott economic and diplomatic sanctions against Israel. All right, so there you have it, the special rapporteur there coming out and calling for a boycott. We'll see how effective that is. Let me introduce our guest for this section of the program. Dr. Mojgan Sabahbia Asfahani joins us. She's an Iranian native and environmentalist who is the people's candidate for Ann Arbor City Council in 2024, starting now as it states on her X account. Well, Mojgan, welcome to the program. Taking a look at first Southeast Asia, there are calls to boycott products there, obviously with links to Israel, or having a noticeable impact on the bottom line of the major brands, which in some ways shows the effectiveness of boycotting. How effective do you think the boycotting campaign is when it comes to the impact that it's making on the company's bottom line? Are they really suffering?
Thank you, Kobe, for giving me a chance to speak with you. It's good to be back. I think the issue of boycott, divestment, and sanction has been discussed repeatedly for at least the past 10 years. And right now, the movement, which was originated by people of Palestine, they called for divestment sanctions against Israel, I want to say 20 years ago, was picked up by student organizations across the globe and in the United States where I am. And there is a huge support and push for that right now in the United States. And there is indications that companies are suffering and their monetary situation is getting jeopardized because of boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel. Specifically, I know that McDonald's and the coffee, Starbucks coffee, have suffered greatly. In fact, there is a Starbucks coffee downtown of Ann Arbor, which has gone out of business. So these things are all true. And similarly, I am sure in Southeast Asia and other places, companies that have ties to apartheid Israel are suffering. But what I want to focus on is that just as we saw with apartheid South Africa, the main force that took South Africa, racist South Africa, out of the global scene was not exactly sanctions. It was the ruination of South Africa in terms of their legitimacy. They had lost their legitimacy. They were isolated in the eyes of millions and millions of people in the world. They were cut off from diplomatic relationships with many, many countries. And that was the main driver that pushed South Africa out of the global setting.
All right, thank you for that, Moshe Khan. We appreciate that. Let's see what our next guests think. Amen, that is Jamil, West Asia correspondent at Global Defense Insight, with her interest lying in West Asia, Pakistan, and foreign policy analysis of that. Amen, Jamil, welcome to the program. This particular case involving Intel, it's a U.S. chip-making giant that I'm sure you're familiar with, to invest $25 billion in Israel or occupied Palestine. At the same time, freezing plans to actually expand its chip-making manufacturing in the States. Basically, it's stating that it wants to invest in a war zone, this genocidal war that's taking place. That's where it puts its interest. I mean, doesn't that make it complicit in this genocide that's taking place in the Gaza Strip?
Well, making such allegations that they are complicitly involved in the genocide, is not like we cannot make that such a big statement. Because, the amount the America is going to invest in the tech making chips in Israel, definitely it is a significant development, but it might have their strategic ambitions to fulfill in the Middle Eastern region. Like as America is losing its position in Middle East, so to grab that position back in the region, America wants to make its foot more stronger in the region. So I believe that having a hold on its domestic production of the chips, America has moved towards Israel for achieving their geostrategic ambitions in the region.
It's time now for the InfoNews section of the program. First up, we're going to take a look at China's economy. It's called China's Economic Strength based on the title that Bloomberg gave it. It said China's incredible growth threatens American and EU economies. That came from the U.S. trade chief. She said Beijing's non-market policies should be rebuffed through appropriate countermeasures. She also called for, quote, defensive policies such as tariffs, as well as measures that are more on the offense, including incentive measures. Can you believe it? You have an economy that's doing well that is a challenge or competition, as the U.S. would like to call it, but based on the measures they are taking and would like to take, they want to make sure that that economy does not grow. Go figure. It's the U.S. for you. Next up, Ukraine is under bankruptcy at this point based on this particular entry. It came from the World Bank, which issued this warning that the public finances in that country are catastrophic. It added that Ukraine could go bankrupt as early as next year unless Western countries agree to write off or restructure its debts. Next up, back to China. China's influence in this case. More than half of the people in Southeast Asia would side with China over the U.S. if forced to choose. Now, last year, only 38.9% of respondents preferred China. Also, China was chosen as the most influential economic power in the region by most respondents. This particular piece of news was picked to show the U.S. how it stands when it comes to its relationship with countries in that part of the world and how they view China. Taking a look at our final piece here, it's the economic losses on the Gaza Strip. The U.N. has come out and said that the World Bank division, that estimates are that the infrastructure damage is at $18.5 billion. This to have occurred in the first 4 months of Israel's devastating genocidal war. Now, that's equivalent to 97% of the combined GDP of the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip for the year 2022. Damages to infrastructure facilities impacted all sectors of the economy, with residential buildings, unbelievable, accounting for 72% of the cost. That's 72%. Those are the ones we picked for our InfoNews section.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
The in-depth section of the program is upon us. When it comes to boycotting Israel, there has been an uptick of anti-Israeli movements in all spheres, from economic ones to cultural ones to even sports. But as with all boycotts, the question is, how efficient has it been? Let's try to find out how efficient it has been or not. So, a good place to start is by looking at the global demonstrations in response to the U.S.-Israeli genocidal war across the world, as outlined in this map. Now, when it comes to this, some examples are seen on this map, with a focus on the United States that you see over here, also Germany, West Asia, and Africa. In terms of the U.S., it had 600 demonstrations, as you see here, Germany with 170, and you have West Asia and North Africa with 1,400. The top five countries were the United States, Yemen, Turkey, Iran, and Morocco. And the key numbers, they're the ones that you see up here. When it comes to, for example, pro-Palestine demonstrations, there were over 3,700. That's 90% that it raked in. Pro-Israel demonstrations, we also took a note of that, over 520, which came in at 13%. And also you have the neutral ones, which came in at, from what we understand, 100. Now, in terms of the total, that came in at 4,200 altogether, the number of demos. Now, next up, we took a look at four different areas that the boycott campaign has actually had its impact. Losses per year, thousands of job losses, $10.5 billion. Israel actually has a budget to fight BDS, boycott, divestment, sanctions, $33 million, $28.6 million yearly, lost to Central Farms, for example, in the Jordan Valley. And then you have student councils, associations of supporting BDS, over 50. And then finally, you have hundreds of artists who have backed a cultural boycott of Israel. Okay? So you can see that actually different sectors, the boycott campaign is having an effect on, especially when it comes to things like culture. Now, let's move on to the next section of this, where we took a look at one example of the impact. The Alshaya Group, that owns Starbucks in the West Asia and Africa region, actually had to lay off a lot of workers based on the franchises that it had. The number came in at 2,000 plus, and these jobs were lost because of the boycott that happened when it came to Starbucks. Okay, so obviously it shows that there's an impact. Moving on to the next item that we thought would be important for you, this would be another franchise chain, if we can move on to the next item here. And the next item would be McDonald's. It actually had to sign a deal to purchase all 225 of the restaurants that comprise its Israel franchise. This followed months of dramatically lower sales due to pro-Palestine boycott action. Now, the next item that we took a look at is also important. This would be the military. Let's take a look at the military boycott. What do we have here? First of all, weapons manufacturers that sell to Israel are supported by investments worth hundreds of millions of U.S. dollars from Canadian pension funds. That's the premise of this. And different military manufacturers in terms of the contributions that they have made. Now, again, this is for Canadian pension funds. From Honeywell to Lockheed Martin to Boeing, and the respective amounts, $217 million, $137 million, etc. Now, let's go to the pension fund itself. If we can go to the next item, how that's broken down. The Canadian public pension funds, well, they have had, it's about $1.6 billion. The exact amount is actually $1.634 billion. The breakdown is in terms of the respective amounts and money that's basically supporting Israeli apartheid, including arms dealers. So how military manufacturers are making out when it comes to the U.S.-Israeli genocidal war on the Gaza Strip. Let's bring in our guests and get more information on this boycott campaign. All right, let's bring back our guests and see what they think. We have Dr. Mojgan Savabia-Svarani rejoining us, an Iranian native and environmentalist. Mojgan, welcome back to the program. Boycotting Israeli-linked products It's been promoted for a long time. We know that. What we'd like to find out, whether this time around is different due to the depth of the genocide that's taking place, the continuous protests, for example, and the length and of the aggression and the onslaught.
I have no doubt that that is the case, which means right now there's a lot more countries that are involved and are actively seeking to boycott Israel. That is absolutely true. I mean, I've been in the movement of boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel, I would say, pretty much since I was like 20 years old. That's a long time. And I had seen rises and ebbs in this whole issue of boycott, divestment, and sanctions. I have never seen such rigorous and fierce determination on the part of the young, middle-aged, everyone, to cut off Israel. But again, as I said before, the main force that will take Israel out is political isolation, is delegitimization of the state of Israel, and the amount of disrespect that they have gained by murder, by killing, by burning, by destroying hospitals, and virtually murdering at will and consciously and clearly with the aim to kill people, going in and killing people. All of this has made Israel extremely clearly in the minds of the world, they've made them extremely unpopular. And their vicious, vulgar attacks on children and women and hospitals and schools and you name it, it has left no ambiguity in the fact that Israel is a criminal, genocidal state, and it is bad for the world.
All right. Thank you for that. Let's bring back Ayman Jamil now. She is the West Asia correspondent at Global Defense Insight. Ayman Jamil, welcome back to the program. We're trying to figure out here whether this boycott campaign is actually having an impact. We know it is, but this time around, I think it's different if you agree or not. Tell us what you think because of the length of how this genocidal war is now 6 months old and it doesn't seem like it's going to end. Do you think that this time around is different?
Well, these various movements will definitely have the impact, and I believe that they are very much timely because the intensity of the conflict at this time is like very high because the conflict is having the deep roots. It's not just of from October 7, it is having the deep roots since the establishment of the state of Israel since 1949, and the Palestinian peoples are facing the aggressions from then, but the impact of such movements is like pretty much timely because such movements can help in changing the policies of the Israelis towards the Israelis towards the Palestinians, because if the intensity of the protests will continue and they will definitely lead the foundation for the continuous international opposition towards the Israeli policies towards Palestinians. So it will definitely have, the BDS policies will definitely have an impact and will put a pressure on the Israeli regime to just change their policies towards Israel, to Palestine.
The recent decision by the U.S. chipmaking giant Intel, INTC, to invest $25 billion in Israel while freezing expansion plans in Ohio has drawn considerable attention, raising serious questions regarding the company's stance. Critics argue that by investing substantial funds in Israel, an entity accused of engaging in the genocide of Palestinians, Intel is complicit in the actions of the Israeli regime. Controversy surrounding Intel's investment decision adds to the broader discourse on the ethical implications of business activities in genocidal war zones like Gaza. It underscores the complexity of investment choices made by multinational companies and the need for critical examination of their actions in sensitive geopolitical contexts. Time now for the quick take section. Mahdi Abbasian is on assignments. Many don't know that boycotting Israel or Israeli-linked products is an act that began a long time ago, as far back as 1945. even before the official formation of Israel. But after the genocidal war that began on October 7th of 2023, well, this movement has gained momentum. The year 1945 is significant. The Arab League organized a boycott before the establishment of Israel in 1948 on Palestinian land with the aim to isolate Israel economically and to prevent Arab states and to discourage non-Arabs from providing economic and military support for Israel. Well, fast forward to 2024, and there are definite signs of the success of boycotting Israel, like the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movements. Over the last 18 years, the BDS movement has built a massive network worldwide. It's supported by things like trade unions and farmers, their coalitions, as well as racial, social, gender, and climate justice movements, representing tens of millions of people. BDS targets are broken down into four sections, so you know it's not just one, basically the economy. For example, these are comprised of consumer boycott targets, divestment and exclusion targets, pressure targets, and organic boycott targets. When it comes to the consumer ones, it includes brands that have a proven record of complicity in abuses against Palestinians. In terms of divestments, it includes governments which will stop doing business with companies that enable the Israeli occupation of Palestinian lands. In terms of pressure, that means pressure on brands and services to end their complicity in abuses against Palestinians. And organic refers to grassroots boycotts of brands that openly support Israeli violence against Palestinians. Now, one of the most recent moves receiving praise was that Google reinstated its No Thanks app for identifying boycotting Israeli-linked companies. No Thanks offers customers the ability to scan product barcodes and receive notifications if the items are produced by Israeli-linked companies. The app's initial removal on November 30th of last year, 2023, was attributed to its description, which mentioned, quote, "Welcome to No Thanks. Here you can see if the product in your hand supports killing children in Palestine or not." Finally, the boycott movement is also met by stiff resistance, especially when it comes to the U.S., the staunch support of Israel. It has actually enacted a law making it illegal for the boycott movement. Many states in the U.S. are using anti-boycott laws and executive orders to punish companies that refuse to do business with illegal Israeli settlements in the West Bank. 27 states have adopted laws or policies that penalize businesses, organizations, or individuals that engage in or call for boycotts against Israel. That does it for this quick take section. Comments or questions, contact information is coming up. The boycott campaign against Israel sounds like it would be the best way for Israel to stop its apartheid policies against Palestinians. But as one of our guests stated, with each Palestinian that Israel murders in the Gaza Strip, it becomes even more isolated, delegitimizing itself. But to what point? To the point of no return? That's the key question. And that's something Israel is grappling with right now. That does it for this edition of the program. Thank you so much for being with us. We really appreciate you putting your time into watching the program, but we would love it more if you send us some comments, critiques in particular. From Yikov Tahvi and the entire team here at Economic Divide, it's goodbye until the next program.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. To all our brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. This is IRIB English Radio. You are listening to Islamic Upbringing, where we discuss problems and questions parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. The answers that you'll be hearing today are mostly based on the book Children in the Quran and Sunnah, compiled by Ayatollah Shahri. And to help us with our questions, we have in the studio our guest speaker, Brother Miqdad, who is an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiyah of Qom. Assalamu alaikum, Brother Miqdad. We've had some very nice discussions with you. Thanks for showing up again.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. I enjoyed it thoroughly as well. Thanks.
Okay, so we've been talking about how children, especially under 8, you cannot reason with them, and it's not right to force them or entice them into doing anything either. What you should do to convince them to behave appropriately and do good actions. You explained that children are more moved by their feelings rather than their rationality, and you explained that in order to touch their feelings, they need to have role models, because role models affect people from within, and people will start acting without needing rewards or punishment. And you beautifully concluded that our feelings are, in fact, the essence of our feelings is our innate nature, which is what we're talking about, which is monotheism, and as explained in our which is our disposition to the divine, to God subhanahu wa ta'ala, which, as you explained, is the oneness of God, the prophethood of Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, and the vicegerency, the successorship of Imam Ali alayhi salam. And so if we are going to be choosing a role model, they are the most compatible for our God-given nature. The question here is, given all of the celebrities, the soccer players, the cartoons that are out there, how do we introduce the imams as the role models of our children?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I think this is probably one of the places where we've kind of lost, right? I don't want to bring about despair, but as one of the teachers was saying, that this is the, you know, that valley of Uhud that the Muslims in the Battle of Uhud abandoned. And when they abandoned, that caused the destruction and also the loss of that battle, basically. This is kind of where we actually made a big mistake, and at our own expense, and we actually are completely guilty ourselves of not just removing the Ahlul Bayt as role models for our children, but actually introducing our children to other role models. And because of that, we've made a big loss. And today, if our children are growing up into adults that have a different ideology, different values and principles than what Islam teaches, and we struggle to get our youths to be strongly ingrained with Islamic principles, it's because they have other role models than the Ahlul Bayt, right? And one of the questions that you get so often from parents is like, I'm really, really, really struggling to bring about Islam to my children. And despite the fact that, alhamdulillah, the communities are trying really hard, but still we find that we're moving with so much difficulty. One of the main reasons is that because we've left and abandoned this very important principle that the Ahlul Bayt play a role model in our lives. And we don't have that. We don't have children growing up saying that, I pray because Ali alayhi salam prayed. I haven't seen, or I'm not sure if you have, children that are let's say, playing a fighting game and saying that I'm as strong as Ali.
Yeah, well, neither have I, thinking about it. Okay, we're going to have to take a break there. After we come back, we're going to be talking about how we should introduce the imams as the role models to our children. Stay tuned.
Hey, stop! I got a better game!
IRIB English Radio presents a priceless gift to parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. English Radio at irib.ir.
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic upbringing. We're talking about how to introduce the imams, the Ahlul Bayt, as the role models to our children, because they are the most compatible people with the innate nature that God subhanahu wa ta'ala has given us. And the challenge we face is the celebrities, the athletes, and the cartoons out there. So what should the parents do? How should they face this issue?
We're going to talk a lot about animations and cartoons and role models that we have out there. And there's a lot of things we can learn from them, because they've applied the principles that we want to apply as well. Obviously, there are a lot of differences as well. And perhaps the one main difference is that at the end of the day, the Ahlul Bayt are fitri, as we said, right? They're in complete instinct with the innate nature of the human being, as opposed to Spider-Man and Ben 10 and Barbie. So on that side, we've got a big advantage, right? But these Hollywood and animations and cartoons, superheroes that have come to our lives, have come in a particular way that we have a lot to learn from and realize what kind of mistakes we made when we introduced these personalities to our children. So coming to the question of how do we introduce the Ahlul Bayt to our children as role models, there's many things that we can talk about. I mean, it'll take hours to discuss it. This, and alhamdulillah, there's so much out there in the literature in terms of verses of the Quran and traditions from the Ahlul Bayt regarding this, that it will take a lot of time to discuss it. I just want to talk about 3 points, and the third one is the main one that I'll talk about. So the first way to ensure that we introduce the Ahlul Bayt to our children is something that starts before birth, and that is to do with halal rizq, right? We have a lot of emphasis on making sure that the fetus that is born is from halal, from halal income, from halal rizq. The Holy Quran talks about how shaitan becomes a sharik, becomes a partner, an associate with our children, right? We have many traditions about how the love of Ahlul Bayt, the love of Ali alayhi salam, is only for those who have halal in them, basically. You all know famously as well that Imam al-Hussein says on the day of Ashura that the people who were standing in front of him, they couldn't understand what he was saying. They didn't realize who he was. And as in, didn't understand the position of the Ahlul Bayt. Why? Because their stomach was full of haram rizq, haram food. So one of the very important things that we need to make sure is that before birth and also in our lives, our income and our rizq should be halal. That we should be earning money through a job that is halal. We should make sure that we're paying all our Islamic taxes, that we're not cheating at work, that we're not using any usury and riba interest. And make sure that we follow the guidelines of Islam in ensuring that our money is 100% halal.
Okay, just before we go to the second point, we're going to have to take a break. After the break, we'll be back to talk more about this. Don't go away.
Ya muqiyal khayrat, ya muqiyal khayrat.
Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam said, O nation of Shia,
Teach your children the poems of Al-Abdi, because he was a follower of the religion of Allah.
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing. We are talking about how we can introduce the Ahlul Bayt as role models to our children. So the first point was that when a child is being conceived, it's important that the income that the parents have is from legitimate and halal wealth. What is the second point?
The second point is to do with the way that the parents deal with the child. And in this, there's two things I'd like to mention. The first one is the parents need to ensure that the primary needs of a child are met, right? And we've talked about this as the foundation of Islamic upbringing, right? That child's physical needs, emotional needs are met properly. And this includes love, respect, security, older independence, self-confidence, all these very important needs of a child, right? The child needs to feel that my parents love me, feel that I'm respected, I'm important, I've got a place in this house, feel safe in the different things that they have, the relationship that they have. A strong and very tranquil and very loving and respectful environment at home, right? Family life is very important. It's a primary need of a child, that I have stability at home, right? These are very important. These really go a long way in ensuring that when they come to understand the Ahlul Bayt and their role model Ahlul Bayt, their inside is not an ocean that's very turbulent, right? Because their love hasn't been met, their respect hasn't been met, etc. So the first thing is parents' relationship with the children is very important. And secondly is that parents slowly and gradually attribute the answering of the needs of the child to the Ahlul Bayt, right? So when you play with a child, for example, also tell the child that, you know, Amirul Mu'mineen used to say that it's very important for parents to play with the child. And so what happens, the child realizes that actually my parents are playing with me is because of Amirul Mu'mineen told them, right? And then they feel actually love for him. They say, wow, I like that guy, right? Because I'm having so much fun with my dad right now. It's really, really good fun. And I just realized that the cause and the source of this was Ali alayhi salam.
Okay, thank you very much. One issue here is that let's imagine that our children do get the traits of do accept the Ahlul Bayt as their role models, and accordingly they also take the traits as well, which is honesty and stuff like that. One problem is that at school, these traits are not endorsed by their contemporaries, by their peers. In school, it's the superficial things like the beauty of Barbie, like the power to hit everyone else of Superman or Spider-Man. That's what really becomes attractive to children. And so when a child goes into their society, especially at school, and finds that what has become a value to them isn't really worth anything to the children in school, they might dislike those traits and turn away from them. What can we do about that?
School doesn't start from until the child is 6 or 7. And by that time, if we've done it properly, they've built a very strong role model in them. This school will have very little effect on the children. Our role as parents is to ensure that we just strengthen these role models very, very strongly. And when you do this, the child becomes very full of strength, innate strength, with strength from within. And this makes sure the child is protected. And then school becomes very little in influencing the child to behave in a certain way or to like a certain thing or to be attracted to something else, because their strength lies with their role model.
Okay, thank you very much. That's all the time that we have, but we will be continuing this discussion in future episodes, inshallah. If you missed it, don't worry. You can always download an archive of this episode and our previous episodes from our website. Simply search parstoday.com. That's parstoday.com.